Knights of the Soul Star Order, defenders of justice and truth, have been ambushed by the evil magicians, the Direwraiths.
This is the world of the Micronauts, a Kroyer, the enemy, and the Micronaut Space Warriors, all sold separately.
Discover Planet of the Apes.
The Shogun Warriors, Guy King with rocket boosters, Great Mazinga with rocket launcher.
Look, it's Godzilla!
Is he friend or foe? You can decide.
Wow.
Launch his claw. Imagine his breath is a blast of fire.
Welcome to the House of Licensed Ideas, Episode 2, presented by Into the Weird, exclusively to our Patreons. I'm Herman Lowe, and of course I'm joined again by my ever-present co-host, the Space Knight from somewhere up in the north of North America. Luckily it's not Seattle, hopefully. And that is Mr. Billy Delicious. How are you today, Billy?
Yeah, I'm fantastic, and yeah, thank God I'm not in the Space Needle. So
Godzilla's going to use that as a toothpick today. Listeners, just keep listening, and you'll see what we mean. So, Billy, we're back with our second episode here of the House of Licensed Ideas, and this time around we're hitting the number two issues for ROM, Godzilla, and, of course, a fan favorite, Micronauts. And all of these issues were great again. Just to give the listeners a bit of a recap, you know, from what happened last time, we're going to do our, you know, quick synopsis and, you know, Twitter style. So this will not be a lengthy episode like the first one, though, because the first episode, we started off with some facts and some, you know, how these series were conceived by the creators of Marvel. And this time around, we don't need to do that. We can go straight into the story and our discussion of what we loved, dialogue, art, etc. But first off, Billy, I want to ask you specifically, ROM, you know, you've got the entire series. I know you're a fan of the character. You've also got the Godzilla Essentials. And then, you know, you've got Micronauts. But I know ROM is specifically your favorite. This issue of ROM, though, did you pick that up recently when you were filling up your run, or did you read this way back when?
No, I've had this one for quite some time. I don't know, for some weird reason, I needed issue 4, I think it was, and then 2 of the annuals for the longest time.
Right.
Those were the only ones. Those were the only ones I needed. I had everything else but those, and I don't know why that is. I don't think there's anything special about those issues, but that was it. So yeah, I've had this one for quite some time.
Yeah, that's the case with me as well. This is one of the issues that was in the long box. You know, my uncle gifted me, and it seemed that he, you know, I mentioned this before in other episodes. He wasn't into superhero comics, but he seemed to love sci-fi, horror, westerns, war comics. And for some reason, there were a lot of ROMs, you know, so, you know, he was obviously a fan of the character. And of course, I was a kid. I never got to pick his brains or anything about, you know, what he thought of ROM. I would have loved to do that, but now I can't. You know, he's an uncle by marriage, you know, my aunt divorced him, my mom's sister, you know, a long time ago, 30 years ago. So we lost touch. There's no way I can talk to him. I don't even know if he's still alive. But yeah, he was a fan of ROM. So this is one of the ones I read, you know, very early on when I was just yay high. And then the Godzilla issue, Billy, is the first time you read it was obviously in the Marvel Essentials collection that they released. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too. You know, I picked up that Essentials because I thought I would never get my hands on any Godzilla comics. Mm-hmm. And I snapped it up. Yeah, and that was a long time ago. I don't even know how long ago when they released that. What, 10 years ago? Maybe more? 15 years
oh,
ago?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's... Yeah, it's got to be 15 years or more. Let me look at the indicia here. It says 2006. So, yeah, 15 years ago.
Right. I enjoyed the series more than I thought I would. You know, I thought it would be... Obviously, it is dated in terms of the dialogue and the content and everything. But, you know, it holds up pretty well because it's funny. You know, is Dum Dum Dugan, he brings the the lighter side of the Marvel U to this series, since it was written for kids. You know, Doug Munch has said as much in interviews, but the humor I think translates well for adults and kids alike, because it's so Marvel-esque that you just it's endearing. You know, so I can see why some kids would have loved this, but some adults too, because, you know, Godzilla fans, they'll lap up anything Godzilla. And I would consider myself a fan of Godzilla, definitely.
Yeah, I'm a big kaiju fan. So, like you said, because of that and just the humor, you know, it's just, you can't help but like this. It's just, it'll grow on you very quickly.
That's right. But Micronauts, though, on the other hand, that's a series you only recently started picking up. I mean, looking at the back issues and so forth, right? So I wanted to ask you about that. So you never saw Micronauts on the stands or in the back issue bins of comic shops, or you just weren't interested in that kind of thing when you were younger?
Yeah, they didn't come to my attention until I started going to comic shops, which was when I was around 15.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember them being a big presence then either. But definitely when I would be at shows, I would see them in like the dollar bins or whatever. Mm. And it just, it never like grabbed me like other stuff did. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
When I was younger, especially, it was just like, oh, I was into X-Men or Avengers or whatever. And there were so many issues of that already to try to get into another series that wasn't very long lived. And I mean, comparatively speaking with like Avengers and X-Men, I just thought, in the back of my brain, I always tell myself, I could pick that up at any time, and I could always pick that up later. But if I really want to know the history of something that's been around for a long time, I need to buy that first. So
yeah,
that's why it took me a while to get, you know, any Micronauts issues.
True. Yeah. I also, you know, got into Micronauts in a weird way. I never, you know, picked the issues up off of the spinner racks off of the stands, because I didn't like the fact that there were these miniaturized heroes running around, you know, Earth, They're stuck at this, you know, toy size, very much, you know, obviously coming from the toy line too. But I thought that was silly. But, you know, a lot of the series is set in the Microverse, where it's just a different universe where everybody's, you know, the same size. It's almost like Star Wars, really. And that's what eventually appealed to me. I think the first time I saw some Micronauts comics was at a friend's house. And then, you know, that's how I got into the series, by sort of, you know, having nothing to do, you know, paging through his comics and then seeing that, you know, I like the art and I like these alien settings in the Microverse. And, you know, so actually their time on Earth is brief compared to, you know, what they would eventually have to do. They would return to the Microverse to, you know, incite this rebellion against Baron Karza. And that's the kind of stuff I like. I don't really like their miniaturized adventures on, you know, in Daytona Beach. But it's pretty, pretty great art from Michael Golden. So we'll get into that today as we see the Micronauts arriving on Earth. So, Billy, let's start this off with our favorite ROM Space Knight. And this is issue 2. Can you give us the specs for this issue?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, it's going to be the lead off team for this is going to be the same for pretty much the entire series. But, yeah, Bill Mantlo, writer, and then Sal Buscema, artist. And, I mean, he does pencils and inks here.
Yeah.
And then we get John Costanza, letters, Glennis Wing, colors, Joe Duffy, editor. You know, some Daredevil fans will recognize that name.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and then we editor-in-chief, dun dun dun, Jim Shooter.
Ah, there we go. Yeah, he did deserve some kind of I'm not gonna say fanfare, Marvel fanfare when you announce him, but maybe in, you know, a what do you call it, the Death Star music. Uh-huh. Darth Vader entry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, great issue by Rom. So since you gave the specs, Billy, I'll start off with my Twitter style synopsis and then we'll switch it up when we get to Godzilla. Okay. Here goes. And this time I stuck more to the 240 character limit. Or is it 280 characters? I always forget.
It's 280.
80, yeah. That's right. Yeah, I just, like I say, I go to Twitter. I pretend to write a Twitter post, and then after I finish the synopsis, I paste and copy it onto my notes. All right, here we go. Rom invades the Lacerium Corporation to hunt down their Dire Wraith CEO just in time to interrupt said CEO's kidnapping. After banishing him to Limbo, one of the kidnappers develops an insane hatred for Rom. Brandy and Steve are having a lover spat, and then Rom shows up, the police hot on his tail. Things do not go well for the cops. All right. That's as much as I could fit in to this limited synopsis window here. So, Billy, what about yours?
Well, I was in like a retro television mood when I was writing these, so just to forewarn all the listeners here. But okay, so here we go. On this episode of Days of Our Lives, Steve catches Brandy cavorting with Rom, but in his heart, Rom only wants one thing: to kill him some Dire Wraiths.
Brilliant. Excellent, man. Oh, that's a good synopsis. And that's very true. Yeah, although I would say it's creepy, but I would say that, yeah, Rom does feel a little bit of a tugging there, you know, towards Brandy too. But yeah, his mission firmly, you know, takes precedent, right, above the affections that he has for this human, who he probably considers at this point in time just a pet. But Brandy,
information.
Yeah, but Brandy's full on, man. That's at least one thing we learned from issue number 2. She likes her men tall, metallic, and Galadorian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the strong, silent type.
Yeah. Oh, this is a brilliant issue. Okay, Billy, let's get into this, man. Okay, the cover itself.
Yeah,
it's a really great cover. I mean, this is Rom. It's a very it's a close up of Rom being menaced by these lasers. And of course, this is done by Al Milgrom. The first cover to issue 1 was, of course, Frank Miller. This is Al Milgrom, and I really dig this cover because it doesn't have a background. It doesn't need a background. This is all Rom being hard pressed by these lasers that are, you know, hemming him in. And you see the typical Rom shine off of his silver armor, plandanium armor. You've got his neutralizer in his hand there. And these lasers causing these explosions, which is brilliantly drawn by Milgrom. What do you think of this cover?
Yeah, I like it quite a bit. I know a lot of people crap on Al Milgrom.
With that?
Especially his writing. But I think when you look at his career and just even look at a couple of small parts of it, his work that he would do hand in hand with Jim Starlin, I think is out of this world fantastic. Yeah. And then, you know, every once in a while, he'd throw out a cover that I thought was pretty good. And this is one of them. I think it's really good. Like you said, it's a close-up. So, you know, he didn't have to do a background and really too many intricate things or anything like that. But it's really cool. It's like, if you're a kid, especially, you're going to buy this comic because you're going to see that and be like, whoa, this is crazy. A robot and lasers and stuff. Like, this screams, you know, 1980s. So, yeah. Early 1980s especially. So, you're going to buy this comic. So, kudos to him for this cover.
Yeah, and man, I agree. I'm a Milgrom fan. Of course, he's not the greatest of the greats, but sometimes people accuse me of being inconsistent with my views or being, you know, illogical or irrational sometimes, because I will crap on people like Carmine Infantino's later art or Gil Kane or John Romita Jr. But then, you know, I say Al Milgrom's great, you know, so people are thinking you know nothing about comic book art. Herman. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have our own personal tastes, right, Billy? I don't know how to describe it. Some people are masters at the craft, and I can see that they're masters, but their eyes, my eyes just don't, you know, attach themselves to their art for some reason. I find some bits, off-putting. Not because it's badly drawn, it's just because their style doesn't appeal to me. Do you have anybody like that you could sympathize with me on this, or is it just me? Am I just, you know, bad at judging good art?
No, I'm actually on the same page as you with some of those names there. You know, I'm not the world's biggest Kane fan, except for when it comes to his Silver Age stuff.
And his covers, his covers are pretty great over.
Yeah. His covers are usually really good. It's just the interiors that are not great for me.
Mm.
You know, so I'm on the same page with you there. I have some people that are like, you know, favorites of mine, or people that I think are at least good and are consistent, that other people just are like, what are you talking about? They're terrible.
Yeah. You know, these days there are hate campaigns for a lot of old artists, of course, I don't like to jump on that bandwagon and rib people or criticize their art too much. There are definitely people that, you know, I also, that sometimes I agree with these people. I just don't want to vilify these artists online. And I'm not going to do that, but I guess I sometimes do that on the podcast because, you know, it feels like we're just having a conversation rather than recording. So I should always remember that. But, you know, Al Milgram's one of the guys that I won't do that with because I have fond memories of his stuff. Like you say, most of it's Starlin related, you know, his partnership there with Jim. But, here he does a brilliant job of the cover. And we know that he's the one who championed Rom at Marvel. So he's got a lot invested in this property. He's got a real passion for this series.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, it's all about Sal Buscema and of course Bill Mantlo's writing here, and especially Sal inking himself. I think he did an amazing job. Whenever he inked himself, so this is no exception here. The first page, though, Billy, the opening splash, man, that one's pretty great. It's a elevated shot from above showing Rom breaking through what I just think might be a skylight or something into the Slycerium Corp. And then Archie Stryker, who's apparently a mobster, as they describe him, he's in the midst of kidnapping the Lycerium manager. I called him a CEO in the synopsis. He's not a CEO. He's a manager. But why? Why would they want to kidnap the manager? It's strange. Hold him for ransom. And they don't know that this guy's a dire wraith. Rom smashes through the skylight and everybody's surprised. And, the issue's story title is Second Coming. You expect more from a title like that, but actually this is just Rom arriving again, you know, in Clareton later on. That's the only reason why they called it this. But he smashes through, and then we've got this great bit where you know, the manager is cowering. He's not a dire wraith who's very, you know, he's not one of the sorcerers or one of the dire wraith warriors. He's very much just a bureaucrat or something. Because
he's a coward.
And then Rom lands. He wants to see the manager, and the kidnappers are having none of this. But first, Rom analyzes them to see that, you know, they're if they are dire wraiths or not, right, Billy? So he has to determine that first. And, once he's determined that, they start shooting at him with no effect. And then he just bitch slaps them in, you know... I love that panel. Spam. Oh, that's brilliant. But first, the dire wraith kind of has a plan. He says his only hope is to turn these would-be kidnappers against Rom. So he sort of says, Rom, he's an alien. He's a murderer. He'll kill us all. And that's what sort of jumpstarts the attack. What do you think about these first couple of pages of Rom versus these kidnappers?
Well, I love Rom's. I love the dialogue all over. It's just the best. But Rom, too. And then these crooks, he goes, no, he's after the guy we snatched, but we're still in his way. Shoot, you slobs. And of course, the Wraith, who's cowering in the background like a turd, is like, Grom's an alien, a murderer, he'll kill us all. And then they're trying to like shoot him, and then that doesn't work. The one guy goes running at Rom like he's gonna hit him with the gun, like pistol whip him. And that's when Rom just, like you said, a big huge pimp slap. And then he says, he goes after the, you know, the cowardly Wraith, and he says, there are none between us now, Wraith. And he says, what are you gonna do to me? And he says, show you more mercy than you showed the once proud Starfleet of Galador. Prepare, Wraith, to be banished. No, not that.
yeah, that's their worst fear, right, Billy, is to be banished to this other dimensional limbo. It's kind of like the Phantom Zone. In fact, you could you could call Rom's neutralizer a portable Phantom Zone projector. You know, because but there seems to be quite a bit of pain involved once you get blasted by this thing if you're a Wraith, because it sort of does leave some you know, residue behind, some ashes. So it sloughs off, I think, your guise that you've been wearing on Earth. You know, your Wraith shape-changing, you know, powers seem to be neutralized by the neutralizer, and then you're hurled into this other dimensional limbo. And they're always screaming when this happens, you know, once they plunge through these dimensional walls. Yeah. I love panels like that when Rom banishes one of them. They're screaming in pain and in fear. So this is worse than death, a fate worse than death. But Billy, we also see here a little bit more of the Dire Wraith's plan on Earth. They're not just hiding out from the Galadorians, you know, spreading across the cosmos, hiding. They've got a plan. They want to turn the technology of underdeveloped worlds like ours, backwater planets. They want to marry their science and technology with ours and with other planets, and then create super weapons to eventually take the fight back to the Galadorians who have defeated them. So that's their plan. Mm-hmm. They want to create these super weapons. And here's one of them. This Lycerium Corporation, the reason why this Dire Wraith is the manager there is they've been outfitting the lasers here with some Dire Wraith tech. So it kind of hurts Rom. He's blasted in the back by Archie Stryker, the leader of the kidnappers. And Archie develops an instant dislike for Rom, and that blossoms into a hatred pretty soon, right? Because he's seeing Rom as an invading alien trying to take over the Earth or something. So even though this guy's, you know, their kidnapping target, you know, the fact that Rom eventually then does banishes him, right, that causes Archie to become incensed. You know, a fellow human destroyed by this alien monster. I can't stand it. So
yeah, he says, Lord, as long as I live, I'll never forget that poor buzzard scream as Rom fried him with some kind of death ray. And he says, I'd do anything to stop that monster from killing another human being. Anything. And then some seedy cop says, perhaps you will get your chance, Archie Stryker.
Oh,
once
and
I inform the others.
That's right. That's right. And that's a hint of things to come, right, Billy? Archie Stryker, let's just say he's going to get an upgrade pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And he's gonna give Rom a real severe headache. But, you know, Billy, there's a couple of great scenes here. This is where Sal Buscema is so great. He's not just great at drawing punches, which is what he's well known for, the Sal Buscema punch. He's also great at drawing machinery getting destroyed or any kind of man-made object, you know, being just devastated here by Rom's strength. Look at what Rom does to that laser on page number 5, the laser cannon. He rips it apart like tinfoil.
and then that vault door,
The vault door is the best, isn't that? I mean, that's straight out of the Incredible Hulk. That's like, you know, Sal channeling his Hulk tenure here. He you know, the manager, right, he runs into the, after we should mention he phoned his Dire Wraith accomplices, which seems to be this is the town of Lansing, right, where this Lycerium Corporation is, and it's probably a neighboring town to Clareton, where Rom first showed up. And he phoned the Lansing Police Department, you know, while Rom were fighting these kidnappers. And then the police chief, obviously being a Dire Wraith in disguise as well, he's going to notify the rest of the Wraiths that Rom is now in Lansing, and he's taking out their super lasers here. But, you know, he locks himself in the vault. this giant vault and thinking that he'll be safe from Rom. But what does Rom do, Billy? Just casually.
Yeah, he just grabs it. Like, he basically puts his hands right through the metal of the vault door and grabs a hold of it and rips it right off its hinges. But skaroom is the noise, which is awesome there. And then Rom says, "There is no place left on Earth for you to hide, Wraith." And the Wraith says, "You may succeed in eliminating me, Rom, but there are countless others who will take my place." And Rom's retort is, "Then they too shall be dealt with, evil one."
Oh, I love it.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
It turns out that, you know, though, this evil one, he does have a means to defend himself, right? He's got one of the Wraith's disruptors, which is a handgun that the Wraiths would more... They would use this quite a lot against Rom. It doesn't seem to be able to kill him, but it causes him some pain. Apparently, Rom says the reason it's called a disruptor, at least we can glean this from his dialogue, is because it disrupts his circuitry, you know, briefly. Because we know Rom's got self-repair capabilities. You know, he's basically a living suit of armor, you know, so, you know, but it does hurt him. He can feel pain. And then,
he shoots him right in the face with it.
Yeah.
Like at close range.
And then, you know, two-gun kid style, or what would you say, Billy? Rom seems to do a quick draw there, but his equivalent of a quick draw is, you know, summoning his neutralizer from subspace and then doing the draw and blasting this guy in the back. And it looks like he's disintegrated in a fiery explosion, right, Billy? Zrak. Mm-hmm. But then we see the you're going to see a lot more of this, listeners, throughout the series, the panel where the Wraith gets hurled into limbo right in that very same panel where he's blasted and he falls into limbo. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it almost like opens up a portal. It almost like when he zaps them with it, zrak.
Yeah.
It, like, looks like it's kind of like melting them or something. And then it opens up this portal to limbo, and then they go falling right into limbo.
That's right. And, you know, we'll get to this later, Billy, when we're at the end of our discussion of this issue. I want to ask you about your favorite sound effects. But you know, here, Rom is one of the comics in Marvel that had the best sound effects. I don't know if you would agree with that. I mean, listen to when these lasers are activated. This is now just after the Dire Wraith, well, gets banished. He manages to, you know, hit a button that just activates all the lasers. And they're blasting at Rom. This is where the cover comes from. Rom hemmed in by these lasers. And you've got the sound effects. Vrizz, vrio, vree. You know, as the lasers caroom off of his armor. And then, you know, Rom blasts out of there. Varoom. And Archie's arrested by the police. But you know, Archie Stryker, he appeals to the cops. And this cop is a Wraith, and Archie says, "We gotta do something," you know, even though he's in handcuffs. You can't just let him get away, you know. He says, "Lord, as long as I live, I'll never forget," like you mentioned, that poor buzzard scream. So, you know, then the cops are staring at this guy like he's insane, but this Dire Wraith cop is saying, they're gonna do something with his hatred, channel it towards, you know, Rom's destruction.
Yeah.
But Billy, then we head off to back to good old Clareton, where we get into the soap opera drama that you incorporated into your synopsis here. So what happens?
Well, then Brandy's at home with her parents, and, you know, Steve shows up.
Her boyfriend.
And of course, everybody's kind of like worried about her because of her encounter with Rom, you know, because she met him first. And then, you know, if you watch TV, it showed him going ape and zapping stuff, and they think he's killing friends and, you know, neighbors and stuff like that, but they're really Wraiths. So, you know, she's, you know, everybody thinks, oh, poor Brandy, she's all shook up about it. And she's kind of like, you know, hey, you don't need to be worried about me. You know, Rom's here to save us from these aliens. And everybody's like, yeah, sure he is. Like, you know, they don't believe her, but she believes Rom, you know, because she talked to him and she has like a, I don't want to say like a sixth sense, but she can tell like that he's telling the truth. So, well, then she did see a Wraith too. So,
yeah. So she's kind of convinced, but she's, you know, made to doubt Rom a little bit here by Steve, because Steve seems to be able to convince her that she was just hysterical, you know, in an offhand way, you know, Billy, but, not really, because she wants to believe that Rom is good, because after all, she's developed feelings for Rom in this short time for some reason, mm-hmm. you know, so...
Yeah. Steve's not cutting it.
No. Steve's not adequate when you've seen a Galadorian up front, you know, touch that silver sheen.
Saw those, even held in those big arms and big hands.
Oh, yeah. Those metal mitts. Yeah, she's kind of like, she reminds me of Alicia Masters and Rom being the Thing. You know, she's one of those girls. Yeah. She's up for some inhuman loving. But, you know, Rom is, the Galadorians are human-ish. They're human-like, you know. It's just obviously, you know, he's been turned into a cyborg. But, you know, we'll find out much later in the series that, you know, they're compatible with humans. You know, they can even breed with mm-hmm. humans, so.
Well, he was a man once, so, you know, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a great bit where Brandy's parents, they seem to be quite wealthy. They've got this lake house with this gazebo and this little boat tied up at this, you know, little boardwalk there. And, you know, I've got a huge property. And then she, you know, says she just wants to be alone and walk with her dog, Tempest. More on little Tempest later. And Tempest starts to growl, right? And then it seems that someone's in the gazebo. Who be he, Billy?
Well, you can see, if you really look in the crosshatching there of the gazebo, you can see a mittened hand.
So you know who's come to visit.
Yeah, so it's, she's like, Rom! And she's like, you came back? And she's like all like getting a little sappy about it. And he's like, yes, I came back because I need information.
Yeah, right, Rom. Like,
oh, I see.
Yeah, she's disappointed. She wanted him to say, hey, you know, Brandy, I felt something between us. Did you feel it too? No, Rom, he's not much for it. For the ladies, he doesn't really know how to talk, because he does feel something for her, you know, but he can't put that into words. That's why he came back, you know, also because Brandy's the first person he encountered. But, you know, there's definitely something between them. It's almost they're like star-crossed lovers, literally star-crossed.
And then you have creepy Steve watching from the bushes. What was this creep doing?
Yeah. Following her around. He was stalking her after she said she wants to be alone. He hid himself in the bushes, and then he sees her talking to Rom, and he thinks, that monster. He's already
look at his face.
Jealous, that's man.
That's a Sal Buscema face there. Look at that, man.
Brilliant Sal Buscema face, man. I love those open mouth expressions, but he doesn't have the spittle, mm-hmm. the spittle string, but whatever.
Yeah.
Still pretty great. And, you know, I love the Rom's face too, though. You know, even though he can show no emotion, the fact that he looks at Brandy and he keeps staring at her in silence, you know, that kind of, you know, reflects his inner turmoil, right, Billy? But also the way Sal drew his, you know, that aperture where his eyes are situated in this dark aperture with these red lights gleaming out from within. That's a brilliant look. And, of course, that's from the toy.
Yeah, kind of looks like, what's his name? The Destroyer from Asgard.
Yeah. That's right. Except the Destroyer had absolutely no personality in just the way they drew him. But Rom, you can actually see the personality coming through the face, you know. And then, you know, we cut to Billy. Now this is interesting. The Dire Wraith so far, you know, they've just been, you know, a singular enemy known as the Dire Wraiths. But actually, there are individual Wraiths that would come to plague Rom. They're each distinct, even though when they change into their Pillsbury Doughboy true forms, right, they do kind of all look the same. You know, just like, you know, some idiots would say, oh, Asian people all look the same to me, or, you know, that kind of thing. For us, that's horrible. But, you know, for us, I'm going to be that guy and be a little bit like that with the Dire Wraiths, because that's the way they're drawn. They all look the same. Right, when they assume their true forms, right? But here we meet three Wraiths, and at least two of them will be recurring characters. You know, they'll be Wraiths that are doing the planning and scheming and actively trying to organize, you know, the Wraiths on Earth to take down Rom. I find these you know, characters fascinating. We've got Rachel Sweet and then Kevin Crawler. And then we've got a Wraith from the previous issue returning from the first issue, Clara Knowles. Now, yes. I'll speak more about that, but Clara Knowles is the first one, because as you remember, listeners, at the end of the first issue, one of the raids left Clareton to obviously check in with the Dire Wraith High Command, if you want to call it that. And that was Clara Knowles, the switchboard operator in Clareton. She transformed into a crow or a raven, right, Billy? And flew towards what looks to be a Pentagon-style building. Yeah.
Yep.
But it is in Washington, D.C. However, it's not the Pentagon. It is a place that they call, I think, Safeguard. Right? I believe that's the name of this. It's a Pentagon, basically. It's kind of like a Pentagon.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to, you know, use that without really saying that's what it is.
Yeah. But
yeah, that's the point they're getting at. And let's be honest, there are probably some raids in there right now.
Yeah. All right, moving on. In real life. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, Billy. Oh man, I yeah, good one, man. How would we know? Lizard people or wraiths? One of those two.
Well, hey, and let's not beat around the bush here. Clara Knowles, she is Norman Bates when he's dressed up as his mother.
Like she looks like that. That's a visual. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You know, what was this comic written by Hitchcock? Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've got a bird, a murderous bird, and then you've got Bates' mother. This is a Hitchcockian, you know, issue.
Yep, you're not kidding.
And speaking about this bird, right, Billy, this little bird, he flies through high security clearance easily, or she, I should say, this raven. Yeah. It is, in fact, a raven. And when she flies into this boardroom, which is this huge shield level style boardroom with this massive globe in the back and these four people sitting around the table, she flies in and says, "Ska!" Sound effect. Ah! And then... The lady on the boardroom table, she says, "Ah, here she is now." And the other guy, this rotund, you know, military type, says, "About time." Oh, he's a senator. Sorry, he looks like a senator. So, Billy, these folks are great, right? Clara Knowles, the Raven, she morphs into her form, her humanoid form of this old Norman Bates mom type. And then she... briefs the rest of the folks around the table. One of them's a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, and that's Agent Crawler, right? And then one of them's a quite a striking-looking woman. She's a scientist, right, Billy? And she will give Rom a lot of trouble. Rachel Sweet. So you've got Rachel Sweet, the scientist, Kevin Crawler, the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, and then you've got this senator. And I can't think of his name just now, but
the Rachel girl, I think her
Rachel Sweet,
other name, I think her other name is Diana Prince.
So she looks like Wonder Woman showing up for work in Washington D.C. You're right, minus the glasses, but yeah, that's a good call. And you know, doesn't Kevin Crawler look like Clay Quatermain? You know, the character of
Yeah, and then that big fat guy, he looks like...
Jabba the Hutt?
Well, that too, but he almost reminds me a little bit of that one guy. I can't remember what his name was during the one big Avengers story. Was his name Craddock or something like that?
Oh,
there was like a senator guy, or was he a military guy or something like that? And he was always like railing on the Avengers, but he was like a shapeshifter too or something. He wasn't what he...
what he appeared to be, It was Craddock. I think it was Craddock,
That's who he reminds me of too.
Yeah, man, this guy, this senator dude, he sports this big cigar, and you know, he's got these jowls and multiple chins, and he's got this angry Sal Buscema expression, you know, clenching his fist. And then they start to make plans around this boardroom. They even do a bit of a Dire Wraith Sieg Heil there at one point in time, where they appear to assume their true forms, right, Billy? But that's kept in shadow. You know, as their shadows loom over this map of the Earth, this giant map of the Earth. That's an ominous panel there from Sal. You know, these shadows of these monster aliens looming over the Earth, which is a telltale, you know, sign there of things to come. And then they cut back to, very abruptly, to the backyard of Brandy's parents, where Steve has now, you know, he's given up spying and he's come out of the bushes and he's grabbed Brandy. Brandy, run for the house. I'm protecting you from this monster. And Rom then feels a twinge of jealousy, right, Billy? Mm-hmm. They even mention that. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like the fact that Steve comes and calls him a monster, but also that Steve's now accosting Brandy. So what does he do? It's kind of like psychological warfare here, Billy. What does he do?
Yeah, it's funny. He gets out the analyzer, and Steve said, "The robot's going to kill me." Brandy's like, "Rom, no, Steve's a friend. He didn't mean any harm." He zaps the crap out of him, and it says, "For even a cyborg, Space Knight is not above jealousy."
Yeah, that exactly. And this is why he knows that Steve's going to think he's going to blast him, even though it's just the analyzer. And Brandy also knows this, but Rom just forges ahead and scares the living hell out of this guy. And look at that next panel where Steve's so happy he's alive. He even says, "I'm alive, I'm alive." So, you know, Rom, he got his revenge there on old Steve for grabbing Brandy. And then the cops show up. It seems that Steve had...
Yeah, I was going to say, the fuzz.
Yeah, he had his cell phone or what? Because he managed from the bushes to dial the cops. But obviously he ran into the house. But still, the police officers, they're there. They're about to get, you know, schooled in the ways of space combat here, because they're nothing compared to Rom. Even though they've got a dire wraith leading them with, you know, the handcuffed Archie Stryker in the back of the cop car, right? But he's still handcuffed. So they just came straight over from Lansing to deal with Rom. And then, you know, from the glove compartment, one of the cops, the chief
guy,
the chief of Lansing Police, he takes this device. And Archie's like, you know, flabbergasted at the tech that the cop has. He says, what is that? You know, and the cop says, "Oh, it's from the military. You know, the military's been, you know, they've been aware of Rom for some time. They've got all these contingencies, and you know, they'll deal with him. He doesn't want to give away his cover. You know that he's a wraith." And you know, Archie doesn't even wonder, like, how can the cops have this level of tech? Some of the other police officers, though, the smarter ones, they wonder, because they wheel out this giant laser cannon, right, Billy? And one of the cops wonders, like, how did the chief get clearance for this military-grade tech?
And then they open fire on Rom, even though he tries to talk sense to them. There's no need for enmity between us humans. I come to aid you in this hour of dire danger. And the cops... fire, and they start blasting them, and of course it doesn't affect them at all, but there's somebody in the line of fire.
Yeah, and that turns out to be poor little Tempest the dog, Brandy's dog. Oh man, Billy, I hate it when animals die in comics, but dogs especially. This is just one of the most disturbing scenes from my youth, reading a comic book, where I saw little Tempest here get riddled by bullets from the cops. You know, come on. I mean, okay, he's standing near Rom, and you would have, it would have been, you know, not better, but I would have said that it would have been believable if, you know, the bullets ricocheted off Rom and then killed Tempest. But the way it's drawn shows the cops just perforating this dog off, you know, off of the side there, right? He's got at least 6 feet between him and Rom, and yet they blast this little dog. It's horrible.
Yeah. You know,
so those trigger-happy cops... And Rom gets so upset by the death of Tempest, the dog, you know, which he blames the dire wraiths for.
Yeah.
He rips the gazebo out of the ground, the entire gazebo, and hurls it at the cops and completely destroys one of their vehicles, right?
The cop says, "Look out, he's chucking the whole blasted gazebo at us."
Yeah. Oh, man, that's ridiculous. And then they employ... one of these Wraith super weapons, and it looks like one of the guys has a video game controller there. one of the cops is aiming the gun, the other guy's got like a video game, you know, remote or something, and they blast Rom. He's hurt, but he flies up into the air and then comes crashing down on this Wraith weapon, swam, you know, destroying it. And then Brandy's, you know, she wants to go to him. Come on, Brandy. Jeez, he's in the middle of a firefight. And she wants to run to him. Steve has to hold her back. And her parents have also now joined, you know, the scene. And, you know, Brandy says, "Steve, let me go. I got to go to Rom. They're hurting him." And Steve says, "I hope that they kill that gleaming monstrosity." And not for the first time, he wonders, right? But why, in a thought bubble, why is Brandy so concerned about him? Steve, yeah, if you haven't figured it out by now.
She's standing right next to her boyfriend who has his arm around her, but she couldn't give a crap less. She's like, poor Rom. And then, here we go, more of the crazy Wraith technology. They're zapping Rom with some kind of like it was like an audio kind of weapon.
It's a sonic emitter. But Billy, this technically means they weaponized one of the cop car sirens. That's what it looks like. Or at least a loudspeaker, or you know, something like that. They weaponized it and they blast Rom with the sonic technology. Brandy's freaking out because Rom's in pain. She can't stand it. And again, Steve is wondering, why does she care? Why does she care if this alien monster lives or dies? Why? Mm-hmm. And then you've got another great sound effect. Vree! And then Rom just, you know, he smashes this cop car out of sheer rage and then picks it up. And then he quickly gets his analyzer out because he knows that there's two people in the car, the chief of police and the handcuffed Archie Stryker. So even though he scanned Stryker before, he scans the cop car and he, you know, determines that the chief of police is a Wraith. And while he's being analyzed, right, the Wraith is saying, wow, that's a great scene, Billy. Now, this is one of the more disturbing Rom, it's not a death because the Wraith doesn't die, but it looks as if he's dying a horrific death here because Rom rips off the car door while still holding the car aloft with one hand, and he hurls old Archie Stryker out of the car. Go, human.
Yeah.
You have no place in this conflict. And Archie's got some time for exposition while he's flying through the air. He's tossing me away like I'm not even worth killing. And, you know, this Wraith is begging for his life. You know, you can see how cowardly they are. He says, Rom, stop. I'll do anything. I'll take you to the others. Don't kill me, please. And Rom just says, what does he say, Billy?
Wraith! And then I strike no bargains with your kind. I make no deals. And then, actually, you know, he whips out the neutralizer, and here we go. Zree! To let its crackling whine be the last sound you hear.
Oh, that's great. That's a great scene, Billy. Now, this is how good Rom is, right? Before he even materializes his neutralizer from subspace, he hurls this car into the air. And while this car is flying through the air, he, gets his neutralizer, blasts the car, and there's a fiery explosion, and the Wraith, the Wraith plummets through worlds into limbo, and then the car plunges into the lake in this flaming heap, like a comet, right? And then everybody, all the humans at least, are horrified. Brandy's parents... That's the chief of police. You know, he's murdered police chief Rogers. And then Brandy's like defending Rom. No, no. And Steve's saying, yes, Brandy, you saw it with your own eyes. Don't deny it.
And then she's like, tell them it was a dire Wraith you killed, an alien impersonating Chief Rogers. Tell them. And Rom's just like, I gotta tell nobody nothing. Screw this. And he just flies away.
Screw this crowd. He's out of there. And then, you know, leaving everybody in even more fear of Rom. As if, you know, they could be in greater fear of him after issue one. That, yes, it's possible they could, because they've just witnessed something, you know, terrifying. And then we have the final panel with Archie Stryker vowing revenge, you know. That robot killed two human beings. I couldn't do anything to stop it. Dude, you're a kidnapper. You're a criminal. You're a mobster. Why suddenly now are you the champion of humanity here?
Hey, but at least he's self-aware. If it takes the rest of my worthless life, I swear I'm going to hunt down and destroy the alien called Rom.
Yeah, he's pretty worthless. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Although, I mean, we'll see. We'll get to that. I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, he's gonna have some moments to redeem himself, right, Billy? But he's gonna get worse before it gets better. But yeah,
sure.
So then, you know, it ends with next issue, like the raging comet in the night. He comes, Firefall. that's next issue, listeners. So we'll get to that. That's a great issue too. So, but this issue, Billy, fantastic. The gazebo fight, the fight in Brandy's backyard, poor little Tempest dying. Oh, this is a very impactful issue of ROM. One of my favorites, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, Billy, final thoughts on this issue. What were some of your favorite bits and your overall impressions?
I loved it, you know, start to finish. To me, it's there's no nitpicks at all. I did love the bit, like you said, we talked a bit about with the wraiths in that Pentagon-style building. You know, so they're showing you this isn't just, you know, like you said, there's not just some random dire wraiths, you know, aliens on the planet just farting around doing nothing. Like, there's like a scheme going on here.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sal Buscema and Bill Mantlo and company are going to, you know, take that and just keep going with it.
Yeah.
Of course, the comic book goes everywhere. It goes, you know, different dimensions and out in outer space and stuff. But usually it's always centered around ROM on Earth and interacting with humans and then trying to deal with the wraiths trying to, you know, use Earth to, you know, make their bigger plans come to fruition.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of crossovers or guest appearances, I should say, with or by other Marvel characters. And that's one of the things I loved about the ROM series, you know, ROM interacting with the rest of the Marvel U. You know, the X-Men, you know, he's got, you know, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. There's going to be lots of great appearances.
Power Man and Iron Fist.
Oh, that, don't forget that, man. Yeah, that's, so many good things that's still to come. So, you know, great issue. Loved it. Loved the sound effects. I can't really pick a favorite. There's so many. But maybe the laser sounds. Ree, vroosh, freet.
Yep.
Oh, it's amazing. So, Billy, let's head off into our next issue, which is Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And this is issue 2. Okay, this is my turn to go with the specs. Now, Godzilla, you know, obviously this comic had some, you know, differed from the look of Godzilla, you know, from the Toho movies. This Godzilla's green. He's more dinosaur-esque. But, you know, I like that. And I think, you know, it was a conscious choice, you know, to make him very similar to a dinosaur. Because, after all, kids love dinosaurs, you know. And, you know, you could see why this had such a massive appeal to the younger readers of Marvel.
Yeah.
Now, this is, again, just Godzilla trashing a city. But it'll get more, the story will get more, you know, it will get deeper in subsequent issues, right, Billy? But here it's firmly it's very similar to the first issue where he's just destroying, laying waste to human, you know, buildings and objects and, you know, human resistance. So the synopsis, the specs are as follows. You've got Godzilla, issue 2, titled Thunder in the Darkness. And the creative team on this is writer Doug Munch, penciled by Herb Trimpe, inked by Frank Giacoya, lettered by John Constanza, colored by Janice Cohen. And of course, you can find this in the Essential Godzilla or in the back issue bins. Mm-hmm. Artist on the cover is Herb Trimpe as well. Okay, Billy, this time it's your turn to lead us off with the synopsis here.
Okay, so Seattle under siege, charbroiled cops, chaos abounds. And say goodbye to the Space Needle as the Big G treats it like a lollipop.
Oh, that's brilliant, man. He does. Mm-hmm. He almost does. Mm-hmm. He almost sucks on that Space Needle hard. So I've also
the
got
cover, man.
Oh yeah, the cover shows you all you need to do. It looks like he's waltzing or you know, like slow dancing with the Space Needle.
Nibbling on its ear.
Oh damn, yeah. Definitely, he's probably, you know, missing his Lady Godzilla there. You know, it's been, what, a million years since the last time he got laid.
He's horny, yeah.
Poor Godzilla. Anyway, you know, my synopsis also includes the Big G, because it's easier doing that, you know, shortening his name to fit into our Twitter-style 280 character limit. So mine goes as follows. Godzilla trashes Seattle while Dum Dum picks the brains of the three Japanese kaiju experts. They manage to save the city of Seattle with a funky light show that lures the Big G to the ocean, where inertia blocks plummet him into the sea. Dum Dum marks it up as a victory, even though they blew up a major power plant without permission. Man, you know, this is crazy. This is the level mm-hmm. of clearance that SHIELD has, you know, to do whatever they want, you know, within the borders of the United States is insane, right, Billy? Dum Dum's mm-hmm. basically like God in this issue. He can do whatever he wants. You know, mm-hmm. So it's a pretty fun issue, I think. You know, I love the dialogue here from Munch. But Billy, mm-hmm. let's talk about the cover. Like you said, it's Godzilla snacking on the Space Needle. Mm-hmm. Luckily, the Space Needle survives, you know, due to this elaborate light show arranged by Dum Dum and mm-hmm. and company. But I love this, you know, cover because it's Seattle under siege. You've got all these, you know, the crowd running from Godzilla, and you've got these spotlights shining on his face. Mm-hmm. And then there's smoke coming out of the Space Needle, you know, so Godzilla must have smelt the food served up by the restaurant up there because, you know, he looks like he's in for a snack as well, not just an ear nibble. And yeah, they say
second searing
issue. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Second searing issue. Oh, man, this is great. And then the splash page, the first opening page is also pretty great. This is Godzilla arriving, you know, at the, you know, in Seattle, and he's crushing these buildings. It's at the docks, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's just stepping on everything. You've got him looming above this giant, you know, cargo ship. And then, you know, the foreman of the dockyard, he's calling it in. He's saying he wants to speak to the mayor or he doesn't care. No, wait, he's speaking to someone else. He says he doesn't care if he's in the meeting with the mayor. Oh, it's the commissioner. He wants to speak to the commissioner, you know, because he's got a problem much bigger than the mayor. Godzilla just nuclear breaths the entire shipyard there. And, you know,
it looks bad, too.
Oh, man, it looks. Yeah,
it's cooked.
Yeah, man, it looks like Pearl Harbor. Sorry to say that, you know, this close to Memorial Day as well. But yeah, it looks like Pearl Harbor there, man. It's devastation everywhere. And it's very apropos to that because where's, you know, Godzilla from? From Japan. Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible. And then you've got Gabriel, the agent from SHIELD, doing some reconnaissance flying there. And then he reports back to the helicarrier. But old Dum Dum, you know, he's in a brainstorming session with these Japanese experts who give him a quick rundown on the recent events in Tokyo where Godzilla devastated Tokyo multiple times and then mm-hmm. fought these other kaiju. So this is more in line with the Toho Studios films and their, you know, continuity there, right, Billy? There's mm-hmm. this great scene that Trimpy drew of Godzilla fighting these kaiju, two panels, and then in the second panel, he's fighting this giant bird with this spiked mace for a tail.
like we said, I think we mentioned this in the first episode, they couldn't use any of the other...
Kaiju,
you know, from Toho. It was like Rodan, all them, they were off limits. It was just use Godzilla, so they had to think up all their own monsters and... You know, they did use a lot of them that were just, you know, kind of based off of ones, but I don't know about that one. That one might be a totally new creation right there, but yeah, they're pretty wild looking.
That's right, man. That's why I'm so surprised that Kirby never drew Godzilla, because Kirby's great at drawing giant monsters, you know, from the 50s, him and Stan, when they did the Marvel Monster comics before Marvel, you know, made it big in the superhero realm. And then Kirby's also good at, some people wouldn't say he's good at it, but he drew Devil Dinosaur. He conceived Devil Dinosaur, and you know that's probably why he didn't want to draw Godzilla. Maybe too similar, but you know Herb Trimpe does an amazing job, though. I would say there's no way I can fault any of his art here, and his characters are also great, not just these big monsters, right? But like, look at the way mm-hmm. he drew the brainstorming session between Dum Dum and the three Japanese folks. Each of them look completely distinct. You know, none of them look the same. You know, you've got this scientist guy, and then you've got this young, strikingly attractive Japanese lady, and then you've got this kid who's sort of Godzilla's best friend. You know, he's Godzilla's Rick Jones. He says, you know, Godzilla must not die, and you must not be allowed to kill him. Godzilla's our friend.
That's right. Godzilla is not evil. Robert, yeah.
Oh, that's great. You know, Dum Dum smoking the cigar. He's got his bowler hat on. He's poring over these charts. It's just some amazing art from Trimpy. And then Agent Gabriel arrives in these little spy plane, in this spy plane, and he reports that basically Seattle is toast. Godzilla takes out some helicopters with his nuclear breath, right, Billy? And then Dum Dum, you know, he's suiting up.
Yep.
There's this Arnold Schwarzenegger commando style panel where Dum Dum's gearing up, right?
Yeah.
And he mentions something. Tony Stark supplied them with Spanflex armor. Spandex Spanflex armor. And he's going to try it out. Oh, it's brilliant.
Well, and that's what I said earlier, too, about the charbroiled cops, because they get really close to Godzilla, and he turns around just right to one of the helicopters with them still in it. It's not like G.I. Joe where, you know, you see something, a plane gets shot down, and everybody parachutes out. Nope. They're in there, and they're cooked.
They're dead, man. They're completely... I mean, even just the radiation left over, you know, that would affect the bystanders here, too, because, yeah, those cops in the helicopters are dead, but the rest of the city of Seattle's population's got, you know, bigger problems 20 years down the line.
Mutations.
Oh, it's going to get... It's hell, cancer and everything. And then, you know, you've got this cop on the ground saying, all cars! You know, he's on the comm there, saying, all cars, prepare for the worst. Oh, man, this is hell. But Billy, now, this is my favorite panel, or my favorite sequence of panels in the book. You know, the Space Needle, you've got folks up in the restaurant at the top of the Seattle Space Needle being told by the maitre d' that they need to evacuate. And then you've got these idiot customers, you know, saying, evacuate? Why? What for? You know, they just arrived. They've paid, you know, they probably had a reservation. And, you know, this maitre d' just trying to keep everybody calm. And then you've got this amazing panel of this woman staring through the window, seeing Godzilla. Look at her face, Billy. As she screams. Isn't that an amazing drawing there from
That's a good one. And then the next one, too. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there's this one woman that, as Godzilla appears at the window and everybody's fleeing for their lives, there's this one woman standing, you know, arms akimbo, you know, looking like she's about to worship Godzilla there, right? It's a monster! Yeah. A monster! And then, you know, the maitre d', man, he's probably the best maitre d' in the world. He should have been like a firefighter or something, because he's saying, ladies and gentlemen, please just proceed to the exits in an orderly manner. Sorry, dude, that time is over. Time for that is done.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And then, we have Gabe and Dum Dum here in these little, like, what the heck you would call those, like, little tiny... like platforms, or ships or something.
Yeah, hovercrafts or something. Yeah, hover platforms.
Blasting Godzilla to try to like get him to get away from there, not kill people. But yeah, it's great. It's a really good stuff too. Like that one panel on the next page where Gabe says, "Hang there, chicken scratching confirmation. Take it out the fastest way you can. You got it," Gabe says. And then, you know, if anybody doesn't remember too, you know, Gabe, he was you know, one of the original Howlers.
Yeah.
You know, way back in the day when Kirby created that team. And, you know, hey, that was, you know, now this is the late 70s, early 80s. It's not as big of a deal, but that was a huge deal when he created that character because Gabe's a black man.
Yeah, he's a black man, part of the Howlers. And Kirby's always been, you know, doing that, you know, with later on with the Black Panther as well. But, yeah, I like that about him. And I like Agent Gabriel a lot. You know, he's brave. Mm-hmm. Man, he's like the perfect point man. You know, for people like Nick Fury or Dum Dum to direct him, because he's a man of action, and he, you know, he's also very innovative in the field. You know, believes he's smart, resourceful. Yeah. I love him. And then, you know, he in fact does take out the power plant, like you say, because they have to in fact kill all the lights in Seattle, because they realize that that is what's drawing Godzilla, or what's fueling his rampage. So Gabriel takes out this power plant in spectacular fashion with two rockets, and then the entire city is blacked out. And then Godzilla, now there's only one light left, and that's on top of the Space Needle, this fire that's been started there. But then they manage to shoot some flares into the sky across the ocean, a series of six or seven flares that lures Godzilla to this cliff. And then they bring up a weapon which I didn't expect, Billy. It seems like lasers and things like that. That doesn't work against Godzilla, but these giant inertia blocks do. It's like a shield secret weapon. It's basically these high-tech mechanized catapults that fire these cubes of granite. I don't know what it's made up of, but they seem to have some explosives in them as well, because once they hit Godzilla, they compress and then explode, and then they serve to push Godzilla off of the cliff. Man. And that's a pretty good plan executed there by Dum Dum, because it works. Godzilla yeah. falls into the water and then he heads out to sea. But you know, next is his next destination, unfortunately, is going to be San Francisco. And then the comic book ends with Dum Dum charting it up as a victory. But then, you know, he's ready to celebrate. But Agent Gabriel shows up and he says, he kills Dum Dum's good cheer here, right? But look at Dum Dum's face in that panel there.
Yeah.
Gabriel says, somehow, after seeing that thing blinded and confused like that, and what we did to it, well, I guess I just don't feel like one of the good guys anymore. And look at Dum Dum. He's horrified by Gabriel saying this.
Yeah.
Saying, you just chalked up a victory for humanity, brother, and then now you're saying that we're the bad guys? Dum Dum's shocked.
And then they have Robert there who's having some introspection and then saying that he understands Godzilla and what's going to go on and this and that. And he's like, I am Godzilla's only hope. And then next issue.
That's right. The champions. Oh, yeah. This is Hercules and his team that's going to come head to head with Godzilla. And, you know, that's going to be pretty, pretty fun. Right, Billy, because they don't always want to keep it in the same formula as the Toho movies where Godzilla just destroys a city, battles the military here, S.H.I.E.L.D. being the military in this case. They also want to throw some Marvel characters in there. And, you know, that's fine by me because, you know, the champions are yeah. great. You know, so we're going to have some fun in the third issue when that comes around as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, Billy, final thoughts on this issue.
Fun issue. I liked it quite a bit. You know, it's kind of just more of what you saw in the first issue, but different location. And then, you know, like you said, we're going to get a lot different in this next issue, the third one, because we're going to get some guest stars in that one, too. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. So I'm looking forward to that. Great art from Trimpy and company here. And there's some pretty good dialogue from Doug Munch. So all in all, very... pleasant issue, a nice popcorn issue. You can just sit down and read it and have a lot of fun with it. But Billy, now we get to an issue that's, well, based off of my previous comments, should not have been great because it's got the Micronauts on Earth. This is not them in their Star Wars realm where they're firmly in the rebellion, but I did enjoy this issue a lot. You know, but, you know, when I first read it, probably not as much, but this time around, it's pretty crazy. This is where the Into the Weird segment comes to play because we've got Micronauts number 2. And can you give us the specs on that before we get into this?
Sure, yeah. This one's from 1978, and it's Bill Mantlow and Michael Golden, writer, storytellers, penciler. So, you know, they're kind of doing the old Engelhart Brunner here and working together with everything. And then Joseph Rubinstein, inker, John Costanza, letterer, and then... The colorist is somebody, I don't know if I've ever heard this name before. Have you? It's like Mooley?
Yeah, F. Mooley. I don't know. I've never encountered that person before. I'm sorry, I haven't. I mean,
that name isn't familiar to me, but yeah, and then Al Milgram, editor as well. So, yeah, and then Earth! Exclamation point.
yeah. No, it's incredible, you know, that this creative team on this book, because you know they're all going to become legends. Well, Bill Mantlow already a legend, but Michael Golden on art. But then, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't actually look at the rest. I didn't look at the letterers. I didn't look at the inkers so much, you know, which I should have done. But you know, now that you and I are discussing comics almost for a living, you know, I'm more. You know, I notice these guys more, but I've never heard of that, you know, F. Mooley, unfortunately. But we'll probably do some research and find out some more things. So, Billy, it's my turn with the synopsis, right? Okay, very basic. The diminutive Micronauts enter Earth just in time to face a Cocker Spaniel and a kid with a lawnmower. Meanwhile, Baron Karza, back in the Microverse, plays Dr. Frankenstein with Prince Argon. The Micronauts escape Prince Shaitan of the Acroyers with the help of a well-placed swipe from a gigantic rake. Nuff said.
Yeah, you're not kidding. You're spot on there.
Yeah, man. I tried to put all the events. There's basically three scenes, you know, in this comic book. So I tried to put all of them in there. What about yours, Billy?
Okay, so get ready with the television. I'm telling you, this is. I really had some old school TV on the brain. So here we go. In this issue, we got a crash landing, a visit from the cryptic time traveler, and more sexual tension than an episode of Three's Company.
If you're referring to Commander Ren and Marionette, hell yeah. And, you know, they're trying to be Han and Leia over here in Empire Strikes Back. That's how bad it gets. But this, predates that, right, Billy? So you think about it, that predates that scene.
And you can see it right on the cover a little bit there, too. You know, he's swinging away, and he's got her in his arms. So what'd you think of the cover?
Oh, yeah. No, the cover's... the cover is good because, you know, but it's a little bit too busy for me. I don't know how else to describe it, right, Billy? I mean, obviously, you've got this kid with the lawnmower in the back in shadow pushing this lawnmower, and the Micronauts are fleeing. So I did like the cover. There's a lot to like here. Them fleeing towards you, towards the reader. But it did look a little bit too busy for me. Like, I think it's the lawnmower in the back. You know, the fact that, that most of the Micronauts are, you know, in front of the lawnmower with some intricate blades and machinery there. It's sort of, you know, there's a lot of detail, but it's I don't know. There isn't a central image to the cover. It's supposed to be the lawnmower, but because the lawnmower is basically... You know, most of it's at the bottom of the page. There's something about the cover that doesn't quite, work for me. But it is the way the Micronauts are drawn. Oh, I can't fault that. The facial expressions. look at Commander Ren and Marionette there. I mean, Marionette looks like Jane clinging to Tarzan there.
Yeah, all I thought is, okay there, Commander, watch that right hand, buddy. Where's that going?
Like groping her in mid-flight there. It's reprehensible there. Arcturus, what are you doing there, Arcturus? Anyway, but not a bad cover. I wouldn't, say that I dislike it. It's just there's something about it that's a little bit weird for me. But the corner box art, you know, with Baron Karza standing there, you know, I've always liked that. You know, that it's going to change soon, but...
Yeah, he looks like he's about to force choke somebody. Oh what? No, never mind. Moving on.
Yeah.
There you go. What about that splash page, though, man? That splash page is pretty cool.
This is great. This is a central image with these, panels, six panels on either side, three on either side of it. You know, with introducing the characters, and that's really all you need, right, Billy, as a new reader coming into this series. Bug, Marionette, Commander Ren, you've got a Croyer, Microtron, Biotron. And, you know, this time around, they've got Commander Ren's name as Space Glider, moniker there, code name. But, in fact, he wasn't really known as Space Glider. That's from the toy line. So this is very early on where they still tried to tie the toy line into most of these characters. They would keep doing that, but not that much, because he would not be known as Space Glider. You know, we would just call him Commander Ren, most of the time in the comic, at least by Bill Mantlo. And I like the fact that the name of this story is just Earth. Right, really? That's the title of this story. Earth.
Yes, to the point.
Yeah, exactly. And they're flying through what appears to be these molecular structures as they're, you know, they've breached the space wall. They're fleeing from Baron Karza's troops, which in this case is shock troops, are the Acroyers who've defected to the side of Commander Ren. They're Acroyers people, Acroyer being one of the Micronauts. And, Prince Shaitan is their leader. They're, you know, in pursuit. But right now the Endeavor... Commander Ren's ship, it's growing in size as it exits the space wall, and then crashes through a barrier into the Earth, and then And then they, you know, have to compensate for the gravity of Earth, so they can't do that in time. They crash land on this, you know, on the backyard lawn of some kid, right, who's mm-hmm. busy mowing this lawn. But some pretty great scenes here, because you don't know what's happened at this point in time. You don't know where they are. You don't know that they're, you know, small in size, even though the name of the comic sort of gives it away, right? And the cover. But then you've got Commander Rand doing a back and forth here with Marionette. Now, he's probably, because he's from 1,000 years in the past, right, Billy, technically?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we learned in the first issue, he was the first Micronaut, the first explorer sent out by Homeworld to survey the microverse and then telepathically gather data. Because, you know, we didn't mention that in the first episode. I think we should mention this now, Billy. Commander Rand is a low-level telepath. And mm-hmm. when traversing the microverse in this hypersleep of his, he's able to, through the circuitry of the ship, he can absorb telepathic data from the rest of the microverse, from wherever he traveled. Mm-hmm. And it took him 1,000 years to do this and to head back to Homeworld. So by the time he arrived, he was very much a man out of time. But then, you know, this might be why he's treating Marionette like this, because he's got these ancient values of chivalry, and Marionette's very much, you know, she's not a feminist, but she's, you know, kind of like, you know, an empowered woman, which is great, because that clashes with Commander Rand's old world sensibilities here. And that's a great dynamic between the two. I like the fact that, okay, everybody knows that they're on the path to become a couple, but mm-hmm. you know, they're both going to vie for, you know, the seat of power, right, in this relationship. Marionette's not going to back down.
Yeah. She's the type of girl that, like, she's like, you know, Commander Rand's like, oh, don't worry, I'll save you. And she's like, I don't need you to save me. I can take care of myself. You know, that's kind of how she is.
Yeah, and she's very capable. You know, that's what I like mm-hmm. about her. She's kind of like she's like Princess Leia, basically. Yeah, but this is Leia before she was Leia. Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't think they consciously based her on Princess Leia, but she's very much got that personality, you know, where she doesn't take a back seat to anybody. And also because she's royalty, right, Billy?
Yeah.
But she doesn't really have a chip on her shoulder. She just knows what she's capable of. She's been a part of the Resistance for a while, you know, resisting Baron Karza. So having this new person enter, you know, into her life who's now trying to take command, that's sort of why she's clashing with the commander. But, you know, they investigate their new surroundings after the ship has crash landed. And then they happen upon this giant metal structure. And what has that turned out to be, Billy?
Well, yeah, in the first picture, you can't tell. You just see metal and like a chain almost. And so, you know, what's going on here? And then the next one you see, you know, and that's kind of one of the first pages where, you know, it's the Micronauts. They look very small, like a perspective thing. They look up and it's a child's swing set.
Yeah, exactly. I like it when, you know, the robots of the team Biotron and Microtron, they analyze this swing set and they say, a metal structure, primitive welding. You know, that's because, you know, obviously the technology of the microverse is far in advance of Earth technology. But, you know, we've got size on our side, guys, so that's going to end up saving the Micronauts miniature, but not before they're being, you know, not attacked, but just, you know, investigated by this playful Cocker Spaniel, right, Billy?
Yeah.
And the dog shows up, rough, and runs around, all happy. And they're, you know, fearing for their lives here. Scatter! You know, and even little Microtron says, I'm afraid even the gods can save us now. Because this giant dog shows up. And then, you know, you've got, I love the way that, you know, Bug, he's the one hanging off of the swing there, right, Billy, right before the dog attacks. He's got his trademark, way of speaking. Tick, 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 Commander. You know, something's coming through the undergrowth. And Bug would always do that. He's got this tick, tick, tick sound, like an insect, you know, rubbing its legs together or something before he speaks. And it's one of the great, you know, quirky dialogue sound effects of comics, I'd say.
Oh, yeah.
So Billy, now we cut back to Homeworld, you know, in the Microverse, firmly under the control of Baron Karza. He's going to dissect and then basically change his captive, Prince Argon. He's going to change him into something more than human, we should say. But first he, you know, sort of has a bit of a gloating session where he says that, you know, even though he hasn't captured Marie, Marionette, she'll be in his, you know, possession soon. And then, you know, he's got, it kind of looks like a scene from Goldfinger. You know, Billy, the James Bond movie where Bond is on the slab and Goldfinger's about to slice his nards in two with a laser. This is what the scene reminds me of, right? Because you've got Argon on this table and you've got all these science types looming over him. And Baron Karza, the premier scientist, of course, 1,000 years old, you know, creator of the body banks, he's going to do something horrible to Prince Argon here.
Yeah, he says, "I intend to experiment with you, Argon, for breeding purposes. Why, when I'm done, you won't even know yourself."
And then it ends with a sinister laugh, right? Wow, that's scary, right, Billy? Just one page, and you already feel like there's gonna, some horrible things are going to happen there. Poor Argon. But, you know, his sister Marionette's got her own problems. She's being sniffed and menaced by this giant pet on Earth, this dog. And then the lawnmower shows up. And then it's this kid mowing his parents' lawn. A Croyer and Bug are in the way of this lawnmower. Luckily, you know, for Marionette, she escapes the dog with the help of Commander Ren and his trusty glider wings, even though she doesn't want that. In fact, she takes offense at being saved. But then, you know, what does Biotron do, this robot henchman of Commander Ren, with the poor dog, man?
He punches him in the nose.
Damn, whap. Yeah, he starts like going all Mike Tyson on this little dog. Well, the dog's like 10 times his size. But then, you know, we had a terrible dog killing earlier, you know, in the ROM issue, right, Billy, where Tempest died. What does Commander Ren do?
Oh, yeah, he's funny. He's like, he goes, "Wait a minute. Oh, wait, the mower's stuck," he says, "the kid." And then Commander Ren is looking to get a, I'm trying to think of what he says. He's trying to get a,
Well, Commander Ren, you know, basically what he does, Billy, is he whips out this laser blaster, right?
A gun, almost,
And then he blasts the dog, Fazam! And you know, he says, he says, "That did it!" So what does this mean? The dog's dead, right?
Marionette says, "You waited long enough." And he goes, "I was busy flying you to safety." And she said, "Who asked you to?"
Damn, yeah, that's a great bit. But the poor dog, man. He's been blasted to kingdom come by Commander Rand's laser gun. I preferred to think he just scared him off. But, you know, there's nothing further to show the fate of this little dog.
And, you don't see him anymore yet.
Yeah, it looks like he's being disintegrated or something. And, you know, then you've got Bug and Croyer versus the lawnmower. Croyer grabs the blade, which they call a whirling fang, because they're thinking this is a monster, right? This lawnmower, which is, you know, now right above them.
Yeah.
Croyer grabs the whirling fan, which is just the lawnmower blades. And then the kid is wondering, like, what's happening to the lawnmower? And then you see the strength of Croyer, even though he's like 6 inches tall. He hurls this lawnmower into the air, and with the effect that he also hurls the kid, you know, who's mowing his dad's lawn. What, this kid's like, what, 13, 14 years old? I don't know. But he's
a teenager, yeah.
Yeah, a teenager. He gets thrown into the air, and then, you know, he falls on his backside, and he looks, and he sees the Micronauts right in front of him. And at that, well, then we see a panel where the Vanguard, the Croyers, who's now, you know, on a mission to track down and kill the Micronauts, or at least bring them back to Baron Karza, they're arriving. They're at the at the space wall. But there's a brief interlude where the kid sort of speaks to the Micronauts, right? He picks up Marionette and Commander Ren on his hand, and then there's some translation you know, in technology that comes into play here, right? Microtron mm-hmm. has that ability to sort of adjust the sound waves of the people involved to have interlingual translation, instantaneous translation for them. Yeah. And that's why they can understand, you know, the kid. And the kid speaks to them and he's, you know, obviously he seems, you know, in seventh heaven because, you know, he's got these little, you know, aliens invading his backyard and they're friendly, even though they torched his dog and destroyed his lawnmower. But worse is going to happen for this kid, right, Billy? He's got some explaining to do to his parents because at that very moment, right after Commander Rand's about to finish up his story of them fleeing from Baron Karza, the, you know, Prince Shaitan and the turncoat Akroyers arrives and they blast up this kid's backyard. Billy, this is amazing. The kid gets blasted too in the forearm. Then he knocks, that happens when he knocks one of these flying ships. There seems to be four of them, right, Billy? Four of these flying vessels pursuing the Micronauts. One of them gets smashed into a tree by this kid, but the tree is completely cut in two.
And it snapped
in half, and it collapses in a burning heap in this kid's backyard. The Micronauts get into action. Akroyer picks up a piece of this tree and hurls it, you know, a javelin style or something at this one spaceship. He takes that one out, scream, and then Commander Ren and Marie flee from this little TIE fighter-esque, you know, ship. Bug takes it out with his rocket lance. It crashes into the swing, but Bug is hurt because the burning debris falls on him. Poor Bug.
Hit him, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, Shaitan is, you know, he's railing and going mad because his fighters are being taken out one by one. So he says, "Photon torpedoes," right out of Star Trek. Fire.
And retrom.
Yeah, and by this time, it's a great special effect. And then, you know, you've got the Micronauts at this point in time. They're back in the Endeavor. You know, they're starting up the ship because this is the only way they can survive, right? But and they do. They in fact engage the hyperdrive, which is akin to teleporting, right, Billy? Because they vanish from sight, and Shaitan says, you know, "They've teleported. Curse you, brother." He's speaking about a courier, his brother. He says, "Well, we'll track you down to hell and back." And then the giant, this little kid, he's so upset that his lawn's been trashed. What does he do, Billy?
He picks up a rake and smacks the crap out of their ship with a rake.
Yeah, and this is right at the moment when they're also engaging their hyperdrive. So they're damaged, and at that point in time, they enter into the hyperverse and blast away from there. But they leave some serious damage in the kid's backyard. Broken lawnmower, torched trees, and then the swing set looks like it's been melted. And then next month, Death Duel at Daytona Beach. Don't miss it. So, Billy, actually an issue that, you know, as a kid, I avoided because of the fact that it's these little Micronauts in this, you know, giant realm. It turned out to be a pretty great issue, packed with action and some funny bits. What do you think?
Yeah, it was neat. And then I forgot to mention, too, on that very first splash page, it looked very Ditko-esque to me.
Oh, you know, yes.
The rest of the issue really didn't, but that page definitely did. And then there was also that pinup in the...
in the center of the issue,
right,
yeah.
Right in the center, yeah.
Wow, Time Traveler.
That. How beautiful is that?
Yeah, that's a beautiful pinup there by Michael Golden. It features Time Traveler, who's sort of a... He's not a godlike being, but he's very much like the Watcher. You know, he's sort of like the Watcher, except he interferes. You know, he doesn't really take action so much as just offers advice, you know. But yeah, there's a pinup of him. He's one of the action figures as well, one of the toys. So that's why they featured him prominently. And later on, we'll learn that he, in fact, had a hand in creating the Microverse. But, you know, we'll get to that later on down the line. But he's a much more important figure than he's presented as at this point in time. So, he pops in and out of the story every now and then. It's kind of like, you know, if you've watched the Thundercats series from the 80s, right, Billy? He's kind of like Jaga, you know, the jaguar mentor of Lion-O, who perished but then shows up as a ghost every now and then to offer advice. Mm. This is what the time traveler reminds me of, Wayfinder. We'll learn much more about him later. So, Billy, pretty great couple of issues here that we discussed. Now I want to ask you, which one's your favorite?
Oh, for me, it's Rom. It's Rom's always going to be tough to beat for me. It's always going to be the tough one to beat, because Godzilla, yep, looks pretty good. It's, you know, usually a good bit of fun as well. And Micronauts too, but the Rom is just, I don't know, there's just something about that comic. I just think they struck gold with that one.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. Got to go with Rom. In second place, I'd probably put Micronauts, because of the awesome Michael Golden art and the great action panels. But Godzilla's a very close third. You know, he's a very close to the Micronauts for me. But Rom is way ahead of the pack. So yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you there, Billy. So listeners, we'll be back next month with the third issues of these three titles. But just to remind you, when we get to the end of the fifth issue, we'll take a little bit of a break from these three series and we'll focus on three other series. And that'll be after the fifth issue, where we just, you know, because we want to mix it up a bit, Billy, because there are so many licensed properties from Marvel that we want to get to. But we'll definitely continue along with these three series and see them out to the end. And so looking forward to great discussions, future discussions that you and I are still going to have about these comics, right, Billy?
Yeah, absolutely.
But for now, that's it for this Patreon episode. We want to thank our Patreons again for supporting us. It means a lot to us. And we'll try to keep delivering content that entertains you and that also obviously has an effect on you and me, Billy, because it battles depression, you know, you and me recording these episodes. And it also allows us to talk about properties we probably wouldn't have discussed on the main show, Into the Weird, but that we've always wanted to talk about. So now we kind of have that opportunity. So thanks, listeners, to you for making that possible as well.
Absolutely.
So, Billy, that's it for us. We're going to ride the space waves, hunt some dire wraiths, and, devastate some cities, probably, have some miniature battles with our action figures to mimic what we saw in Rom today. But that's very much it for me. Take care of yourself, weird listeners, until we meet again.